Hello and welcome to a new edition of Podcasts from the Edge with me, Peter Bruce. We are publishing this episode on Budget Day, so I'm pleased to be able to talk to my friend Songhez Ozibi, head of the Rise Mzansi Party, a member of the GNU Governing Coalition, and chair of the Standing Committee on Public Accounts in Parliament, which has turned into a place of real and often painful accounting. Songhez, hi. Let's start here with a view from space, a general conversation about South Africa and where we are. And the blue planet you see from space is actually quite a dangerous place at the moment. We are thankfully here in South Africa, far away from, you know, the global hotspots, but we also seem to have a way of squirreling ourselves towards them. In the US, Donald Trump has had us in his sights for more than a year, imposing much tougher tariffs on South Africa than most other countries. And while there seems to be little doubt that that's because we took Israel to the International Court of Justice in 2023, it's one thing knowing why you're being, treated so roughly, and another knowing what to do about it. How well or otherwise do you think we or this country or the government has handled the crisis in its ties with America?
Good afternoon, Peter. So, you know, I've always worried that South Africa would not be able to survive another shock after COVID, because for various reasons. So whether that's another pandemic or it's an economic shock and so on, what I never expected was the kind of disruption that we're seeing from Donald Trump. And that's because I think that, and particularly it is an ANC problem rather than individuals, that the ANC doesn't perceive the world in the way that the rest of the normal world perceives the world. It's being stuck in the 80s and 90s, fighting an old Cold War and that kind of thing. And they found the perfect adversary in Donald Trump, because in some ways he takes them back. He validates their failure to kind of move forward and understand the world for what it is. And so I always worried about the shock, firstly, but also the ability now to manage a Donald Trump who's unpredictable. I think the one thing the South African government has done well recently, Peter, is by keeping their mouth shut.
Yeah.
Right? Because there was a time when we, in the collective sense, we were combative. We wanted to dispute everything that Donald Trump was saying and doing and so on. And that was further antagonizing the situation, because I guess people felt that we're defending South Africa's sovereignty. But the perspective I gave to a few senior people in government was that, like, think of poor Canada. What have they done? Right? America's best little brother, the best little brother that you can think of, and neighbor or favorite cousin or whatever. They're supplicant in many ways. There's absolutely no reason to bully them at all, right? And yet, yeah, Here they are. So you're not special. Shut your effing mouth and just focus on minimizing the risk and diversifying your options and making new friends in places where you didn't think you'd make new friends, right? So ditch this 80s nonsense. The EU is your friend, right? Not your enemy.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you about that. So what new friends have we made? We know that China is there and it's a big market. Do you think that there is a warmer or closer or more beneficial relationship developing between South Africa and the EU because of what Trump has done?
Absolutely. It has caused a shift in South Africa's general attitude towards countries that are not China or India. Let me give you an example. So at the World Trade Organization, South Africa tended to be unnecessarily obstructive, and it's a consensus organization. And so the Europeans would get very frustrated with South Africa because we want to fight a global South battle and that kind of thing. And that doesn't quite work. So that's the one shift that we've seen. The cooperation at the WTO is much, much better because the Europeans are also looking for friends. And so there's improved perspective. The second thing, believe it or not, is Narendra Modi's strange relationship with Benjamin Netanyahu. So, you know, in the context of the BRICS and what South Africans crudely assume about the BRICS, it's made people sit and think, so if we attach so much value on this relationship, why does Modi speak of Netanyahu so warmly and he calls him my friend,
yes,
and brother?
Yes.
So the whole situation, in my assessment, Peter, has brought a new realism to foreign policy.
Yeah.
However, I still think we're incredibly naive in many respects, in the sense that we
With regard to the world,
by the way, we might have improved, right? But we're still incredibly naive. I mean, we still think China is our friend because they like us. No, China likes certain things about us because they've got their own interests. That's not why they're friends with us. Yeah. When they remove tariffs on South Africa, it's not because we're special. They've removed tariffs on 52 other African countries. You're not special. You know what I mean? Like, these things become embarrassing when you see how naive we've been, and that still worries me.
Yeah. And there is also the point, I thought, during the G20 meeting in Johannesburg in November, that the European leaders went out of their way to, you know, to be warm to Cyril Ramaphosa and to not flatter him, but, I mean, to, you know, to be... it was a very nice gathering of people. Obviously, Trump wasn't there making a noise and all that sort of stuff. And they knew that. And despite that, they nonetheless, you know, did their best, I thought, to make the South Africans feel, appreciated and valued. But Songhezo, you know, it's one thing to not do anything stupid when you're faced with a very stupid person like Trump. It's another thing to do absolutely nothing. I'm still stunned that we don't have an ambassador in America. There is no leadership in the embassy there at all. Not only are we not saying anything, there's no one there to say anything. Surely a sharp-witted South African man or woman running the embassy could at least be briefing the rest of the country. Interviews in media, visiting Chicago, visiting governors and mayors around the country. Isn't there a duty to have someone running an embassy of that size? Otherwise, what's the point of it?
No, it's one of the ways I think we're naive, Peter. And by the way, we haven't had an ambassador there for a long time.
I know. Yeah.
Very long time. That's the one thing that's not happening. You know, one of the reasons I was disappointed with Rasool having to come back is that the Americans love him. The professionals, they absolutely love him, because there's a couple of things that Rasool understood, that you have to work the Washington think tank scene. You have to work the lobbies. You have to work the staffers and so on. And Rasool has the gift of the gab, right? And I spoke to some senior US diplomats, and they were literally saying, Cyril should get Rasool over there sooner, not later, because they could feel the gap that you need somebody who knows how to work the scene. Of course, he makes an amateur mistake in an obscure gathering. He says things that he shouldn't say, and it comes back to bite him, right? Because the Israeli lobby is that sharp and organized. But
well, they fund most of the institutes, you know. Yeah.
Most of the institutes. But here's the thing, Peter. So there are two things. One, I don't think the U.S. administration is particularly keen to receive an ambassador from us, firstly.
Yep.
And secondly, I believe there is a factor of what kind of ambassador would do well over there versus what the ANC would approve. And I think we're stuck between the two. If you were to ask me...
It's a long time to be stuck.
I know, listen, when we chose a National Director of Public Prosecutions at the last minute, and so, you know, it's not unexpected.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. I would pick an Afrikaner to go and represent South Africa in the United States. There's lots of those that are patriotic, that can do the job. It would be a tough job, but I think one should have long been found right now, because for this moment, you need somebody who can represent South Africa with that kind of background.
Yeah. And I wonder whether you don't think there might be a moment here now of a sort of diplomatic arbitrage, you know, because Trump has had a bit of a setback. The Supreme Court has told him that his tariffs are sort of null and void, and he can't have done them the way he did them. Not that he can't do them, but not that way. And the new American ambassador just landed in Pretoria. And I wonder, between the new ambassador landing and Trump finding another way to punish us, there isn't a moment where we could do something positive, not to make Trump go away, but just to make to diminish the hostility, which is unnecessary, unfounded, and unproductive.
I wonder what that could be, though, Peter, because the U.S. official. So here's the interesting thing. So someone you and I know well, had a chat on the sidelines in Davos with Marco Rubio and Elon Musk separately. They know the stuff is BS. They know the stuff is BS, but they've got a language they use, which is, it's not politically useful to say the things that you're saying to me. Now, Peter, how do you work with that when your interlocutor knows that all of you are engaging in BS?
Yeah.
It's not the real thing. Yeah. I've spoken to other people who've kind of interacted with the U.S. administration at a high level. And I've given them a proposition. I gave it to the president as well. I said, give Donald Trump two things. Give Donald Trump mining rights to platinum. Give Donald Trump for free a site on which to build a Trump Lodge, 7-star, with an airstrip on the Kruger Park, the biggest Transfrontier National Park in the world. And you'll call it the Trump. Peter, it actually really is that simple. That's what the Syrians have done. That's what the Qataris have done. So if to answer your question, we have to engage in corruption. I don't know what else we can do.
Well, now that his tariffs have been rebutted by the Supreme Court, we're in a way in quite a fortunate position, because we've made absolutely no promises to him at all. Whereas if you're the Swiss, you know, you've brought him a gold watch and whatever it was, a gold bar, it all looks kind of pretty silly now. And Cyril looks like, you know, he stood his ground and did the principled thing. But it still doesn't get us out of the hole. You know, if you're a wine farmer or a farmer of any kind who had exported product to America, you're in a bit of trouble, because, you know, those sanctions or those tariffs are hurting.
Yeah, so you know, and by the way, Peter, it's funny how these things kind of has a cross-pollination effect. And that is, although the tariffs have been removed, well, that version of the tariffs, right? That version of the tariffs have been removed. In a weird way, he's now more determined than ever to have a tariff regime, because he hates losing.
Yes.
He hates losing. He doesn't like being overruled institutionally. He doesn't like the limits to power. He's a bit like Zuma. He just handles it differently, right? And I think that, you know, in my assessment, what we need to do is to just try and not piss the guy off. Let him go off on his own. Don't piss him off, because you're not dealing with a rational person here.
Yeah.
Diversify your options. You must work very hard at that, which I must say the government has been working hard. They really have been working hard at diversifying our options. The only thing I'm worried about is their ability to negotiate terms that have maximum economic benefit for us. But the awareness of diversifying is something that they have been doing.
Well, one of the avenues that they've sort of half succeeded in, but as you say, it's not as with South Africa alone, is China, right? So the trade industry and competition minister, Park Tao, he's just gone to China, signed an agreement there that allows our exports into China, into that country, duty-free. But first of all, it's not a free trade deal. And quite frankly, it's all a bit murky or cloudy. I don't want to suggest anything you know, darkly intended about it. But we don't know what's in this deal. You know, is it just food and minerals? Well, you know, why would the Chinese tariff imports of our minerals? I mean, they need them in the first place. You know, it's not as if we are beneficiating them here, first of all. We're just sending them rocks. And that's they're happy with that. But what about value-added exports? You know, does it, do we get to export cars to China? Or do we, you know, do we export pumps or whatever it is that we might be making? Somehow, we, you know, why don't we know what's in this deal yet? It's crazy.
So the deal is not special, Peter. What the Chinese have done for South Africa is what they've done for 52 other countries on the African continent. They just announced our portion first. So substantively, the deal is no different. The Chinese have got entry tariffs for goods coming from countries they consider to be their competitors. What they've done is they've reduced or removed those for African countries. Why? Because they're also searching, looking to diversify their own options because they're looking for certain things. So this is an arrangement of mutual interest because the Chinese are also trying to solve a problem that they have. And they've determined that the relative to the African manufacturing and so on, their fans are a lot stronger and able to offer competitive pricing within the Chinese market, even with African competition. So basically, they are winning 8-0, and they've decided, what if these guys score two goals? The final score is 8-2 anyway. Yeah. So what does it matter? So that's the one thing. The second thing is, over the years, the Chinese have done great strategic interventions for them, not for us, in South Africa. You know, in his State of the Nation address, the president mentions efforts to rescue the ferrochrome industry, right, to assist the ferrochrome industry. Do you know that with South Africa being the biggest, having the biggest reserves of chromium in the world at 71%, the Chinese own the company that has the biggest portion of South Africa's reserves. That's Samanco Chrome. So the Chinese know that if we say, okay, we're going to help you smelt ferrochrome, the majority of it is done by their company, which is owned by Sinosteel anyway. So they can't lose. Yeah. So they've built strategic leverage over time in that way that, you know, it can be a great deal. It looks like a great deal, but they've done the spade work over the last 15 years and they are able to offer that kind of arrangement. The opportunity we have is in agriculture because they were getting a lot of their produce from the US. They're getting it from South America and so on. Yeah. They can get a lot of that from South Africa. And
Wandile Sihlova, we agree with our common friend, now hugely promoted as he's now the presidential special advisor on agriculture and land. So you can have a special advisor on agriculture and land, but you can't have a minister of agriculture and land because, you know, politics means you've got, you know, you've got to have one guy in charge of it. Anyway, I mean, it's all too much. But, you know, the point to make about agriculture is we've recently been more successful. We've negotiated product by product, you know, peanuts and avocado, pears, whatever it might be, into China. But the fact is, you know, to get the phytosanitary, one of John Steenhuisen, agriculture minister's favorite new words, to get those deals right in for China, that takes a very long time. And so if we now have new products to put into China because of this free entry in, you still got to negotiate all of those health things. You know, are they, it takes a long time. And you make the point earlier, we got the people to do that kind of negotiating. Are we good enough at that sort of stuff? You know, it took a long time for avocados. It's going to take a long time for gooseberries and whatever, and whatever. So, Ngeza, what about the other big sort of international flashpoint? We'll leave Israel out of it for the moment. Is Russia and Ukraine? How have we done there? I mean, our whole object has been to try to demonstrate our kind of neutrality, right? So we are non-aligned, we don't take sides, but we patently messed that up at the beginning, right? So Naledi Pandor, for all of her disadvantages, as a minister, put out a statement when the Russians invaded Ukraine, saying, you know, they've got to withdraw, get out, it's wrong, you're invading a sovereign country. And Cyril Ramaphosa told them to withdraw the statement, told Foreign Affairs to withdraw the statement. And then there were a whole lot of votes in the UN, as you know, where we abstained or voted against, et cetera, et cetera. And there's been a bit of a struggle to establish ourselves as truly non-aligned. And I wondered whether you think we've actually done it.
No, we haven't, Peter. I mean, the problem with non-alignment is that nobody likes you in the end.
Yeah.
Right. So, it's hard.
You're in the middle of the road.
You're in the middle of the road and you're going to get run over. And I think that's what has happened to us, because somewhere in between, you also have to pick the interest that is most important to you, which means despite you saying you're non-aligned, it's clear with whom your interests lie, and whatever you're saying rings hollow, which I think has been the case with the Ukraine-Russia problem. You know, Peter, I also think that we try and get involved in too many things in terms of foreign affairs. Don't have the economic and military leverage to make a difference anyway. And I think there is value to making a strategic choice to say, we're going to kind of leave certain theaters to certain actors, and we are going to get involved in things that are closer to our interest regionally, which is on the African continent, it might be in South America, etc., parts of Asia, where we feel our interests are directly threatened. And I think if we had that attitude, you can just issue statements on everything else, so maybe work through other countries and so on. I don't think that we make those kind of strategic choices well. I mean, notwithstanding the fact that, you know, India has fallen out with the US again because Trump is so unpredictable. I thought India and Brazil did great initially. I mean, with all of this going on, which was to look after their strategic interests, the Indians get their weapons from the Russians because them and the Chinese are not friends, right? Yeah. So the Indians had to be careful what they say about the Ukraine-Russia war. And they knew that they've got to be careful. And they were quite clear about why it is that they've been careful. We don't do that. We don't communicate that.
No. You know, I remember very well in about 1981, I was working for the Financial Times and I was visiting India. I was reporting on Indian industry. And I was taken, I think, to it was called Hindustan Aeronautics in just outside of... not outside of Bombay, I forget the name of the city at the moment, but I was they took me there because the FT was in a British newspaper and they were making a British jet there, the Tornado, I think it was at the time. And I said it was all very nice. You could have eaten your breakfast off the floor. Everything was so neat and tidy and clean. And there was a door in the room, so I went towards it to open it, and three or four people sort of descended on me and pulled me away from the door. I said, what have I done? He said, no, you can't go in there. I said, why not? And they said, because we're building a MiG-29 in there. And I wasn't allowed to see the Russian aircraft. So the Russians have been, as you say, supplying Indians for a very long time. But how well have we done with Iran? So, you know, we don't know what the number is, but sufficient evidence, I suspect, exists that the Iranian government shot a lot of protesters last month when, you know, people were on the streets calling for, not regime change, but also they were complaining about prices and inflation and food. Now, we're quick to turn on Israelis for behaving appallingly in Gaza, and quite rightly so. But when the Iranians shoot their own people, We're completely quiet. In fact, we actually were on a naval exercise with them at the time, which even though we tried to prevent their participation, it didn't happen.
I actually think the South Africa-Iran partnership is possibly one of the most ill-conceived. Iran, in the consciousness of the SA government, occupies an undeservedly elevated place.
Why?
In terms of what our interests are right now. I think there's a lot of, there's quite a few of these relationships, Peter. So it's like Cuba. It's a sentimental relationship, right?
You can understand Cuba in a way. They've fought for us in Angola and Namibia, but why Iran? Where's that come from?
No, but that sentiment has always been there. Well, where it comes from, but I know where it comes from. So remember, in 1979, when the Iranian Revolution happens, who tried to sustain the incumbency of the Shah and so on, was the CIA. And at that time, the CIA is arch enemy number one. And in terms of the geopolitical balance of forces at the time, Iran was a big friend, right? And the ANC has never forgotten that. And so they enjoy this elevated status, such as Russia.
Yeah.
A bit of commercial interest. I mean, we get nothing from them, frankly. We can do without it, right? Cuba falls into the same category and so on. And that's why I felt that one of the ways in which we can reset our approach to geopolitics is to get rid of the ANC old guard and the ANC as a whole out of government for a while, right? You need that reset because it's like a childhood memory. You know, they can't get rid of it. It grooms our interest sometimes.
Is it, Thabo Mbeki was, I don't know when he said it, but every time I look at my social media, he's on some message or other warning about, you know, what he claims will be the collapse of the country if the ANC is pushed out of power, because his claim is that it would become ungovernable. If there was no ANC, there's no order in South Africa. And to an extent, he's got a point, you know, and we've spoken in the past about how deeply woven into all aspects of South African society the ANC is. You know, it's got a legitimacy at grassroots level, in the churches, in the schools, up through the townships and rural villages. Without it, is this country, is it capable of functioning?
It can, but it depends who replaces it or what replaces it. I must tell you, any arrangement where there are parties like MKP in there is not going to end well for us.
Yeah.
Right.
No.
So he's half got a point. I don't agree that we have to retain the ANC at all costs. What we need are strategic options of what could replace the ANC. The ANC won't die suddenly. I think in 2029, they'll still be in there, but as one of the main players rather than the biggest player in the room. Right.
Yeah.
We better have a plan for then and after that. I must also say I've been in conversation with people from within the ANC universe. There is a recognition that the decline is terminal, that there's got to be something that feels like the ANC but doesn't behave like the ANC.
So I'm good. Yeah. So before we carry on there, because I'm going to come back to the ANC, just talking about Iran and the military to get us home to South Africa, the same people who ignore a presidential order, right, to stop this Iranian vessel joining the exercise of False Bay in January, are now being asked by the same president who gave that order to patrol the streets of the Western Cape and Gauteng. I'm frightened at that prospect. I don't know how you feel. I mean, do the police really need military help? You know, if you properly led, and you've only got to look at the current inquiries going on in Parliament and the Madlanga Commission to know that they're not properly led. But properly led, could the police do the job? Surely not. Surely they could do the job themselves. You know, the UK did the same sort of thing in Ireland, Northern Ireland, in 1969. They sent in the army. And the army stayed there for 37 years. I mean, do we really want to send the army into the streets of, you know, Mitchell's Plain, Khayelitsha in Cape Town? It sounds...
No, we don't. We'd rather send in the cops. But the situation, the dysfunction, and the over stretcher base of the SA police is such that you need a stopgap. We also don't have enough money to keep the army patrolling the streets for even 2 years.
Yeah.
So that length of time won't happen. But, you know, Peter, let me share one of my frustrations with you is about this situation with you. Is that, I'll give you an example. You know, the firearms register system for the police hasn't worked for years. I found out today.
Yeah.
Since 2022. You know the thing that, you know, when a cop books out a firearm, it gets entered onto your system, what gun, what serial number, how many bullets and so on. When they bring their gun, then they count the number of bullets. Is it still the same gun? And if there are two bullets missing, what did you do with them? And where's the report that they uploaded on the system, right? So because of a commercial dispute, I got the judgment a couple of minutes before we started. That system has been off since 2022.
Oh my off. God.
Okay. What has increased is police firearm thefts, use of police firearms in committing crime, etc., because that system doesn't work. The other is where you keep the forensic evidence. So when the cops are taking pictures and so on, all of that those pictures get uploaded on the system with electronic tags and so on, so that you know that this bullet was used in Port Elizabeth in another crime and so on.
Yeah.
That's also been off since 2022. Now, of course, in an environment with corruption and you can't do those things, if I'm a gangster in the Western Cape, I'm going to be more brazen about what I'm doing because the chances of the crime getting solved, right, are much lower. And how do we solve that problem, Peter? We send in the army.
Yeah.
This is the thing.
The army is there to... Army soldiers are trained to kill people, you know. That's what they do.
That's the only thing soldiers know. And they want to kill people, and that those same communities are going to say the army should leave. But it's not politically correct to say it's not a good idea. So all of us are being careful what we say, but it's never a solution, Peter. Solve the systemic problems. Mm. The Hawks, Peter, have a 50% vacancy rate.
Yeah.
So if you can't investigate crime, bringing in the cops is not going to help you with that problem. They're bringing in because the army that's going to help you.
Yeah. So the Western Cape, the DA would argue that the Western Cape had been asking for the power to, or Cape Town had been arguing for the power to, for its own metropolitan to police to investigate, and the Minister of Police won't grant them, you know, won't devolve the power to them. Would they be able to make they think they'd be able to make a difference, or is that all just politics?
I think they're also naive, Bina, in many respects. I mean, the problems in our police are so deep and systemic that, yes, great leadership and vision would be very useful, but there are so many structural problems within the police that even if you gave the DA that power, it wouldn't work. I mean, also policing is a national competence. And you're always going to have this tension between the national police service. So let me give you an example, Peter. If you don't have this systems integration, so theoretically this system can tell you that the gun that was found at Peter's house, or those fingerprints, are linked to a crime in Port Elizabeth, right?
Yeah.
If you don't have that system, so you know, if you are a silo in the Western Cape and you don't have that system working in the background, you still can't solve the crime. You still can't solve the crime. So devolving power to a provincial authority does not in and of itself, given the structural and systemic changes in the police, doesn't solve the problem. Anyway, that's my opinion.
Yeah. But presumably, provinces that can, you could have a sort of an asymmetrical devolution, couldn't you? Provinces that can function better with the police or education or health services should be able to. And provinces that can't, like the Eastern Cape, which can do nothing, shouldn't have any powers at all. I mean, you know, giving the Eastern Cape the power to run its own hospitals is a death sentence to many patients. They can't do it.
We have a constitutional problem. You always have to have a law of general application, Peter. you can't have a law that applies in certain places but doesn't apply in others. I mean, that's the one. By the way, in my second book, I've written a whole chapter on this stuff. I'm a big fan of devolution. I'm a huge fan of devolution. In fact, devolve it to city level. And you have the police, the local authorities, and the national prosecuting authority collaborating to fight particular types of crime and allocating resources accordingly. So I'm not saying you speak up because, you know, I'm not a fan. I have a chapter in my book about the kind
of constitutional.
And that's one of the propositions that I make, right? Which is somebody sitting at the judicial level somewhere doesn't know what I'm dealing with in, you know, in her manners.
Yeah.
Please, can I work with the prosecutors to solve the problem?
Yeah. So, Ngeza, back deeper into South Africa, how do you feel about the new narrative that we've turned the corner economically, that Cyril's reforms are starting to bite, the green shoots all over the place, you know, the trains are moving, the ships are coming in and out, everything's suddenly, you know, let's put it this way, the direction of travel is up rather than down. Do you buy it all?
I half buy it. So I think there was a bit of rhetorical flourish in what he said, but he is correct in that we are beginning to turn the corner. It's absolutely, in my view, objectively true. Because I've also been tracking certain things. It's just that they've got to be careful about how they expect certain things. So let me give you an example. They've previously been opposed to the idea that you could concession, you know, Transnet's infrastructure to private players. They've actually done it now. So it can actually begin to happen finally.
No, but they haven't. So it goes that they haven't done it yet. It's on paper, but it is not done.
No, I'm getting there. No, I'm getting there, Peter. So I'm getting there. So I'm saying, in terms of the high-level decision-making, they've done it. So Eskom's turned around for you. They have gone some way in cleaning up Eskom's balance sheet. And it's objectively true that it looks a hell of a lot better than it did, such that Eskom will soon be able to access, I think within a year, the capital markets on its own, right? So, you know, if the restructuring goes well. So that's a real benefit. We take it for granted, but the fiscal framework is beginning to work. Debt service costs are down, right? And South Africa's debt, it's got little to do with the movement of the dollar. Most of South Africa's debt is local at a sovereign level, right?
Yeah.
So debt service costs are down. We'll, for the first time, I think, in this budget, dip below 400 billion for the first time in a while, because we were somewhere in the order of 430 billion. So I think for the first time, we'll be paying less than a billion rand a day on debt service costs in quite a long time. So what I'm trying to say
is that because... Yeah, go on.
That is because, Peter, so there are certain things which are not easy to spot. So Eskom's debt problems have long infected the sovereign balance sheet because of the guarantees the state gives to Eskom and other state entities. If you tackle that problem, it reduces the risk for the sovereign, right? In that the see-through is much better. The seep through onto the sovereign balance sheet is much better. And ratings agencies will like that because you've committed a large chunk of money to solving that problem. That's number one. Number two, you've taken some policy decisions. Policy decisions. That's why I'm saying what you said is half true. Some policy decisions to say, we're going to have private operators on the transmission lines. We're going to have private operators on rail, et cetera, et cetera. Which in terms of how you look at state exposure and potential speed of investment, it begins to look better. And if I'm a ratings agency, I say, this is actually, when I look at 2 years ago and I look at now, the picture is beginning to look different. Now, I said it's half true, right? The reason I said it's half true is because we must now get the effing stuff done. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean? So it's nice to talk about it. But I want to know when. And one of the things I shared with Enoch was the most important thing, if you want to improve sentiment, is momentum. Which means you promise something, you announce a plan, you start doing it, you provide an update because it is happening, and you do it within the same financial year. We do that, you begin to see the value dropping to the bottom line. We don't do that. We take forever. And that's why I was saying to you, Peter, it's half true. You know, it's true in a way, but the implementation continues to lag for me, and that remains a problem.
Absolutely, you know, and there's implementation. Transnet is one thing, right? So we will have private trains on Transnet railway lines in about 2 or 3 years. That's what I'm told by experts. Enoch Godongwana, the finance minister, may know better, but I've tried my best to speak to the most qualified people I can. 2028, if we're lucky, we get a private train on a Transnet route. We don't know how many trips they'll be able to make on. So at the moment, what I'm being told is that there are very few trips available, being there and back, Joburg to Durban and back. There are about 1,000 of those movements a month. The private sector may get 10 of them, but we'll have to see how that all works. Concessioning, we've concessioned the port in Durban, or one terminal in Durban. Nothing else anywhere. I know there are plans to do. There's nothing at Cape Town, which is an extremely poorly run port by the sounds of it. And, you know, it's just, I understand that you have to talk more than you do in some of these things, because you are trying to get momentum going, and that some of these things are hard politically to do. But reform worries me, because, you know, the big question about reform, Songo, is, has he got enough time? You know, what if there's no Cyril? Is there any reform?
No, this is a problem, Peter. And you know, like I talked to these guys in cabinet, right? They traveled to China on a state visit. There's like a whole delegation. I think the president also went. And they were still marveling at how organized the Chinese are, et cetera, et cetera, musing about the trip. When on the way back, there was a detailed memo from the Chinese premier's office about action plans already before they have landed back in South Africa. Do you think we do that? We don't. This is the problem, Peter, right? That's the problem. So the speed with which we move is also directly linked to the language we use and the candor with which we communicate with the South African people. This is what I would say, Peter, if I was the president in my state of the nation.
Yeah.
That there's lots of money in South Africa, circa 2 trillion rand already available. The South African government does not have enough money to invest in all of these things. It will take us 10 years. We've taken a decision that by the end of this year, we need to have captured into public goods about 700 billion of that money to go into rail, to go into XYZ. To do that, we're going to need Parliament to process the following bills very quickly, so that we can start employing South Africans. You can't treat a reform bill like any other bill. No, it must get on the first ticket in Parliament, because you're trying to solve a crisis here. But what happens, it becomes like any other bill. It takes forever with public comments and all manner of things.
Is Ramaphosa's problem not that his party fundamentally is divided on the matter of reform, and he doesn't know how far and how fast he can push it?
You know, Peter, I can't put a finger on it. My sense, because I talk to ANC MPs a lot, I mean, there's still more of them than any other civil party in Parliament.
Yeah.
And that is, when I make the same explanations to them, but I use plain language, they go, that makes sense. Right? So there is also a disadvantage to the careful language, because you don't want to be honest with the people that there actually is no Santa. You know, it's me. There's no truth really. You know, I put the gift under your pillow.
Yeah.
Right? So the point I'm making is, I also think the political opposition is overrated, in the sense that when I have explained the same concepts to, I mean, I've explained the concept of strategic ownership by the state, right? Yeah. To say, if the government chose to own 51% of Transnet, it's still a controlling stake. But it just means out of every rand, 49 cents comes from somebody else, and they get to put people on the board and that kind of thing. And we are transparent about how we govern this thing. What is the problem with that? Is it being, you know what I mean? So once you have that debate frankly in that way, people get it. I find that within government, so careful. They use opaque language.
Yeah.
And I think we suffer a lot of harm from the failure to be candid.
And so by not being able to speak plainly to people, is this, talk politically about, you know, we've got local elections coming later this year or perhaps early next year. And then a general election back in 2029, further along. What is, in the absence of it being able to talk plainly to people and truthfully, what is the future of the ANC? Can it lift its vote back above, you know, can it do any better this year than it did in 2024? Or does it get worse?
No, the people that I speak to in the ANC put its prospects at even lower, like 30%, between 30 and 35% at best. So, look, and I mean, you know what, Peter, it's okay for the ANC to stay at like a certain number of votes because, you know, it is a large historical organization. The failure is that there are just too many South Africans who are upset with the ANC who don't vote.
Yeah.
So what is like 8 million votes for the ANC could be 25% if more people voted and took an active decision. But I think on that one, we've turned the corner, Peter. People can now imagine life without the ANC controlling everything.
Yeah. Yeah. And what about leadership? I mean, are there any...
Sorry? Carry on. Now, I don't think the instinct with voters is, with whatever frustrations they have, is that we must go back to the ANC. It's actually that the ANC must go. Right? Mm. So that's why I'm saying, in as far as the ANC's hegemony in South Africa, we've turned the corner.
Yeah.
It's going to be difficult to put the genie back in the bottle.
Yeah. What about leadership in the party, the ANC? Are there any alternatives to Paul Mashatile, the deputy president? And normally the ANC would elect his deputies as a successor. We have Cyril Ramaphosa's brother-in-law, Patrice Motsepe, being mentioned. He's a mining magnate, very rich man. He's been pushed or canvassed to put his hand up for the leadership. Ronald Lamola is an interesting guy. He's a foreign minister. Surely we're not going to get any more provincial capos, you know, from the Eastern Cape, somebody who's slogged their way through millions of ANC committees and schlenters and God knows what to come and run the country. It's got to be, we've reached the end of that road, surely, hopefully.
I think that the prominence of Patrice in the context of the ANC's presidency is an indication that in terms of his own timber, that the ANC has given up the ghost. I don't think there is something that you know very well because you've been around the block 10 times from night before 94 and onwards in South Africa, observed from the 80s. You know, the ANC has lost this feeling, and that is to hear that there's an ANC leader speaking somewhere and you want to go. They've lost that.
It doesn't matter what. Yeah. Absolutely. No, doesn't matter what it is.
A lot of people just won't go, and that's very significant.
And to the extent that South African politics, Songezo, is about occupying the center, the political center, how might the DA, second biggest party in the government of national unity in the country, how might the DA exploit John Steenhuisen's decision not to stand for re-election as leader in April? Who does it have to elect, and what does it have to do to get from the low 20s to the, I don't know, high 20s, which is what it says it's trying to do?
In my view, the DA's problem is somewhat similar to the ANC's problem, in the sense that in terms of what the DA needs to get to the DA should be in the upper 30s, Peter Paye. It should be.
Yeah.
When you look at how badly the ANC has done in the last 3 years, and its failure to turn the country and itself around versus the DA's resourcing and so on, the DA should be doing much, much better. The failure of the DA is, I still maintain, is in its unwillingness to accept what it will take to get more voters, more black voters, that is, right?
Yeah.
So we've just spoken about the ANC's convening power. The problem is the same with John or Jordan. If people hear that either of them are speaking somewhere, they're not gonna go. Right?
Yeah.
It's an intangible confidence thing that you don't give us the confidence that you can be our daddy, right? Because you also shrill. You shout a little too much, you complain a little too much, you never offer a compelling vision, you use the ANC too much as a crutch, and you actually need a leader that people want to listen to, actually.
Yeah.
Because he or she, and I think that DA has given up on that as well. The ANC has given up. The DA has given up. It's going to replace John with somebody who's not terribly better than he is. And that's...
You know, what you want, though, is people to be interesting without being, or being having the power of convening without being populist.
No, it's not about being populist, Peter.
Which is way too easy. Yeah.
No, it's not about being populist, Peter. It's about having the gravitas and the willingness and ability to hold different fractured pieces of the country together. Right?
No, I'm sure that's right.
That's what elevates you to the next level, which is, I might not agree with Peter on everything, but I will sleep better at night knowing Peter is in charge.
Yeah.
Right? The DA doesn't attempt to do that.
Yeah.
And that remains a weakness therein. So the ANC finds itself in a similar situation. And I think to that extent, the country remains in peril. The country remains in peril. Because on the populists, Peter, getting, you know, the people, Peter, that say we must engage in extrajudicial killings because somebody has got a funny accent. Right?
Yeah.
You know, does the DA step up and speak of it? No, they won't. But they should. Yeah. Because they're preparing to leave the country.
Yeah. What about your party, Songeza Rizom Zansi? I know you were hoping for a much better result than the 0.42% you got in 2024. But you've now joined forces in a way I'm not really sure I understand, with two smaller parties. Does it mean you'll contest elections together now?
We'll contest the local government elections together because we split a lot of votes between us in 2024, which was unhelpful to either of the parties. So that is the first thing. The second thing is that in a local government election, you need to find way more candidates than you do in a national election. Everybody's got a similar thing. So we're eliminating competition between our respective candidates by deploying...
For the local election.
For the local election, So it is an electoral... Yeah. It is an electoral cooperation pact, which is different to the to the moonshot, in the sense that we're not continuing to contest each other. We're going to be on the same path.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. And good luck with that, by the way. And just to end off this conversation, because we're publishing it on the same day as Enoch Godongwana announces his 2026 budget, what do you think we can expect from him? He can't surely be funding all of the promises that Cyril Ramaphosa made in his Sona opening State of the Nation address 10 days ago. What do you reckon his three key targets are going to be on Wednesday?
So what I know he's absolutely focused on is on wrestling the sovereign balance sheet. That's a big disciplining factor.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
you know, how wild he will spend on certain things. I also expect that he will go for the easy targets in terms of tax proposals, like sin taxes and so on. I think they've become counterproductive, by the way, but that's a debate for another day. And one thing I'm looking forward to is to see whether the promises of greater government efficiencies are going to start coming through. Because one of the things we're quite ready to do as our committee is instances where the government departments and agencies that wasted money and so on, we're going to take it away. We're going to reduce their future budgets. They want to get more, right, in line with that spirit. So we're not going to get more.
Yeah.
And we're quite ready to
do that. And you've got the power to take it away, don't you?
We've got the power to take it away. I mean, when we are to condone a past historical kind of allocations at this past time, all of the members, they looked like they were looking ill. They didn't want to do it. They're quite keen to instill some discipline. So I'm looking forward for him to start pointing to specific areas where we can help him with brutally tackling the inefficiencies that are there.
Yeah, great. We'll stop there, I'm afraid. But Sonke Zozibi, thank you so much for your time. Thank you all for listening. I'll be back with another edition of Podcast from the Edge. And until then, take care of yourselves. Bye-bye.